This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
I'm Margaret Flinter.
You know, Margaret, it's interesting to watch how healthcare is playing such a prominent role in political races around the country. In the Massachusetts governor's race, incumbent Deval Patrick is being challenged by a former health insurance executive and the current state treasurer, who's been very outspoken about Massachusetts' budget woes over healthcare. Even though the latest polls show that voters are mixed over Governor Patrick's performance, polls do show that a majority in the state still support their healthcare system.
Well, the biggest unknown in many ways at the state and the national level is whether costs will go up and how much and when, if ever, will they start to come down as we reap the benefits of some of the reform efforts. But beyond the dollars for premiums, there are some good news stories, I think, that have come out of Massachusetts' experience with health reform in particular. And one of them is what we've seen there in terms of tobacco cessation. You know, when they implemented health reform, one of the changes they made was to mandate coverage for smoking cessation counseling and prescription drugs, including for Medicaid recipients. And the result there has been the sharpest drop anyone's seen in the population of people who smoke, particularly among Medicaid enrollees. It went from 38% to 28%. And that's just good news in terms of both healthcare costs and building healthy communities.
It really is. And it's spreading nationally as the healthcare reform bill will provide broader Medicaid coverage for smoking cessation. We all want to see more programs like this when it comes to healthcare.
And there's a lot we can learn from all of the states, but I think we also can narrow it down even more to what individual communities can do when they come together to improve their health. So here in Connecticut, it was quite a pleasure last week. We had our fifth annual Weitzman Symposium. Mark, you did a great job introducing some physical activity in the form of dance
we
into the middle of
dancing.
It. We got people up and dancing. But the focus was obesity, and I particularly enjoyed Mayor Joseph Curtatone of the city of Somerville, Massachusetts, talk about a community that came together to improve health, and what a leader they've become across the country through their Shape Up Somerville program in preventing and reversing childhood obesity.
They are certainly in shape in Somerville. And speaking about keeping our minds agile, the Department of Health and Human Services has launched their Community Health Data Initiative. It really brings together the best minds in technology and data and information. And it's trying to attempt to liberate the data that's been locked up in the recesses of Washington far too long, help all of our communities figure out better ways to innovate and improve our own health care.
A new liberation movement, Mark. I think that's one we can get beyond. And turning to today's guest, Dr. Paul Grundy is here with us to talk about what corporations are doing to get better value for their healthcare dollar for their employees and for their employees' dependents. Dr. Grundy is the IBM Global Director for Healthcare and the founder of the Patient-Centered Primary Care Collaborative.
Speaking of innovative ideas, I noticed in the op-ed in the New York Times that we might want to start paying people to stay healthy. In response to a story they ran about paying people to take their medication, it seems like there are a lot of employees and employers who like the idea, and we might see it further develop in areas of weight loss and smoking cessation.
Well, I'm sure it won't sit well with everybody, but money is a motivator, and if it works, I'm not sure that that's a bad thing. And no matter what the story, you can hear all of our shows on our website, chcradio.com. You can subscribe to iTunes to get our show regularly downloaded, or if you want to hang on to our every word and read a transcript of one of our shows, come visit us at chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have feedback, email us at chcradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. Before we speak with Dr. Grundy, let's check in with our producer, Lauren Bonner, with headline news.
I'm Lauren Bonner with this week's headline news. Doctors treating Medicare patients won't see a reduction in reimbursement fees that were supposed to take effect Tuesday. Medicare won't begin processing claims under a reduced payment formula for doctors until June 18th, anticipating that Congress will intervene this week. The delay is the latest in a string of efforts to prevent doctors who see Medicare patients from receiving a 21% reduction in the payment formula that's used to reimburse these providers. Over the weekend, President Obama called on lawmakers to avert the pay cuts, faulting Republicans for the delay. He also pledged to work on a permanent solution to fix the way Medicare doctors get paid.
After years of voting to defer these cuts, The other party is now willing to walk away from the needs of our doctors and our seniors. Now, I realize that simply kicking these cuts down the road another year is not a long-term solution to this problem. For years, I've said that a system where doctors are left to wonder if they'll get fairly reimbursed makes absolutely no sense. And I'm committed to permanently reforming this Medicare formula in a way that balances fiscal responsibility with the responsibility we have to doctors and seniors.
Until a permanent solution to the sustainable growth rate formula for Medicare is agreed upon, the temporary fixes by Congress will do more harm than good to control the cost of Medicare. As new regulations roll out under health care reform, the Department of Health is trying to balance market stability with flexibility for families and businesses when it comes to their health plans. With the department's announcement of the new grandfather rule, businesses can keep their current plan while providing important consumer protections that give Americans, rather than insurance companies, control over their health care. Department of Health Secretary Kathleen Sebelius said these new rules are carefully written to make sure the grandfathered plans still have the flexibility they need to make reasonable changes.
So if health plans significantly raise co-payments or deductibles, or significantly reduce benefits, for example, just stop covering treatments like HIV/AIDS or cystic fibrosis, they lose their grandfather status, and their customers then have the full set of consumer protections as new plans.
Critics are saying the changes could end up causing millions to lose their coverage. But the White House says the flexibility in the regulation means that routine plan changes under health care reform wouldn't affect grandfathered status. On a more conciliatory note, the Department of Health has awarded $23 million in grants to states and health systems to test medical malpractice reforms. Three-year grants will be issued to implement pilot programs, and one-year grants will be issued to plan future programs, all in response to calls for an overhaul of the medical malpractice system. Today on Conversations on Healthcare, we're exploring transforming care in the workplace toward a model that's more focused on primary care and preventative services. Workplace medical clinics adopt the principles of the traditional medical home that put the patient at the center of the delivery process. The services are also tailored to the company's specific healthcare needs. Take Care Health Employer Solutions Group, a division of Walgreens Health and Wellness, operates over 400 on-site medical clinics around the country that can range from as small as a single nurse on site all the way up to a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week clinic with a staff of as many as 60 physicians. In all cases, the patient receives continuous and comprehensive care from one person who serves not only as the direct provider, but also as the coordinator of care. Peter Hotz, Chief Operating Officer for Walgreens Health and Wellness Division, says there's a need today for a more robust primary care system when it comes to a company's healthcare needs.
Some of the biggest things we can do are to promote engagement with the healthcare system, to help people take care of issues before they become chronic, and for those that are chronic, to make sure that they're adhering and complying with medication regimens and treatment regimens, so that we prevent these chronic issues from escalating into a situation that requires hospitalization.
Focusing on prevention and management translates into healthcare savings over time, something else employees are seeking. According to Take Care Health, companies save as much as $4 for every $1 invested in on-site clinics. Although some companies worry about the need for significant marketing to encourage employees to use the facility, Hote says it's more simple than that. The biggest driver has been the traditional word of mouth. Let's turn now to our interview with Dr. Paul Grundy, who's been transforming the way IBM purchases its employee health care through the patient-centered medical home model of care.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Dr. Paul Grundy, IBM's Global Director of Healthcare and President of the Patient-Centered Primary Care Collaborative, a coalition that advocates for the use of patient-centered medical homes. Welcome, Dr. Grundy. Your focus at IBM has been to transform the way IBM purchases healthcare for its employees around the world. You've served as the Director of Healthcare Technology and Strategic Initiatives for IBM. What were you seeing at IBM that convinced you that there was something fundamentally wrong about the care you were buying? How did you diagnose, if you will, the problem as a lack of patient-centered primary care and begin that transformation to a new model?
So what we were really seeing was an intense focus on rescue care. We found a huge variation in price and in quality across the United States. And we saw, you know, because that's where the money flowed, we saw a real intense focus on quote-unquote high-end procedures.
You're very focused, though, in on outcomes and evaluation studies, and there have been a lot on the impact of implementing a patient-centered medical home model, but they all seem to come from systems with defined patient enrollment, Intermountain, Geisinger, Group Health, to name a few. But IBM's millions of employees are all over the globe in communities large and small, getting care in big systems and in small practices. How much impact has IBM itself seen on improvements in care, you know, in higher value at lower cost for its employee base in recent years due to your efforts?
In and around the Mid-Hudson, where we're where we have, you know, I don't know, 100,000 lives or something, a significant employer, we have the largest concentration now of NCQA medical home certified practices in the country. I think it's the last time I looked, it was about 11% of the whole nation's. I mean, that's a community that's not integrated. It's not a Kaiser. It's not a Geisinger. It's not an Intermountain. It's real America, as I call it. I mean, how do you change those places where we buy 96% of our care? That's a very interesting question. I mean, it's a question that our nation is trying to answer right now. And, you know, certainly they rolled out the announcement on June the 2nd of the medical home pilots, the advanced primary care medical home pilots by HHS, is at the state level is beginning to address that as well.
Dr. Grundy, let me ask you about the Patient-Centered Primary Care Collaborative for a moment. Since its inception, you've brought together this prominent group of stakeholders representing employers of, I think, some 50 million people across the U.S., as well as a couple of 100,000 physicians, leading consumer groups, and now some of the top health insurance companies. So the question is this: how is that collaborative viewing the federal health reform law in terms of its potential impact on furthering your objectives, on furthering the patient-centered medical home concept? And do you think the administration has seen this as a fundamental strategy to reduce costs while we're advancing universal coverage in the United States?
Yes, I would say that not only this administration, but the last administration, with Secretary Leavitt, got it, and we've been working on it bipartisan. We have Newt Gingrich saying, you know, the single most important thing that you should, can, need to, have to do is medical home, from the Republican side, and we have the President on June the 8th for the 27th time. So it's widely broad bipartisan, and I think it's understood universally that there's no healthcare system in the world that works without having a robust base of primary care, community medicine, and prevention.
Dr. Grundy, you're known as a critical thinker both in the areas of practice redesign and payment reform, and I want to focus a little on the payment reform side because there's no single best payment structure for medical homes that have been established. In some pilots, the primary care provider or practice gets an additional per member per month payment. In other systems like the VA, it's a closed system with you know, no fee-for-service payments. What are the most promising strategies going forward, and do you anticipate there will be any one best payment methodology? And as the primary care medical home changes get fully incorporated and really become the norm, what's the likelihood that payers, whether public or private, will be willing to continue to pay a bonus? And won't this ultimately get incorporated into the cost savings that the country needs to find?
I think that's a great question. And the answer is you have four or five knobs, right? You have dials that you can turn to get the outcomes you want. And when you take one dial, let's say fee for service, and that's all you use, and you turn it on, right? What are you going to get? Too many services, right? I mean, it makes sense. If you pay for high-end procedures, you'll get high-end procedures. The system responds to the money. If you pay capitation, right? So if you pay a single capitative fee, I mean, what do you get? I mean, the outcome that you get is that the docs will want to see as many people as they can and deliver as few services, because why not? I mean, that's where the money is. And another dial that you could use would be, you know, to pay for outcomes, to pay for value, to pay for you know, either the whole community and how well they do, or your individual patient and how well they do. I mean, you take those dials and, you know, you start somewhere and you dial them up or dial them down.
So when we look at the evaluation studies then, going back to those, Dr. Grundy, we do see some dramatic gains being reported, right? Significant drops in inappropriate emergency room use, decreases in readmission to hospital, preventive admissions, costs in treating certain chronic conditions. Seems that's outcomes and data that's hard to get on a large scale unless you have electronic health records and health information exchanges. Certainly, there's a huge push to do that in the United States, but what's the collaborative and IBM's take on the need to mandate that practices go to electronic health records within a very short period of time? Are you saying that you really can't achieve these goals without that kind of electronic health record, or are you still at the encouragement phase versus the mandate phase for your providers?
You know, with HIT, with data becoming actionable information at the point of care, you know, we're really going to have docs that are smart. I mean, we're going to have a registry in which they can see exactly what's going on with their patient, with their population. You know, reminders that you now get from your bank. I mean, it's really a phenomenal transformation, and there's. You know, there's billions of dollars coming down on the docs right now through ARA and other mechanisms to begin that transformation, but it's early. It's a journey, and it's early.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Paul Grundy, IBM's Global Director of Healthcare Transformation and President of the Patient-Centered Primary Collaborative. You really have a global perspective on healthcare, you know, both by the dint of you were a son of a Quaker missionary and you spent your earlier years in West Africa, and really by your work, you worked as a senior diplomat in the United States State Department facilitating health and diplomacy. More than most, you're no doubt aware that the developing worlds don't have the kind of healthcare manpower to implement this model built on personal relationships with a physician, yet they are very focused in on building strong primary care infrastructures. In fact, there seems to be a much more of a trend towards the use of remote technology, community health workers, and primary care workers of all kinds. What do you see for the future of primary care in the developing world, and are there lessons for us in their work?
It isn't about face-to-face time necessarily. It's about relationships, and some of those can be asynchronous and some of those can be distant. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in some places, even here in the United States, our patients now are up to 25% to 30% of their visits being portal-based or email-based visits and not face-to-face. I mean, I think those kinds of enablements, will really help in the developed world. We did a solution for Tristan da Cunha, the most remote island on the face of the earth. It's 7 days boat ride from Cape Town, 300 people, linking them to the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, you know, where they get their appointments online. And we now have some of the docs that are delivering this kind of care in the United States. We have one, Chuck Kylo in Portland, who I think something like 70% of his visits are asynchronous. We have one employee who moved from Portland to New York and continues to have him as his doctor. You know, now we can deliver services literally anywhere in the world, including the most remote inhabited island on the face of the earth.
I think that's true, but it's going to really require a cultural change. My four children are comfortable using Facebook and communicating with people all over the world. I'm not sure we've trained this generation of primary care providers to be asynchronous. There are certainly a few leaders in the industry, but they do seem to be a little behind the times in terms of that. I think the model you're referring to might have been out in Washington State, where there are a few, but they're really the exceptions. Do you see the health training generation, the next generation, really being trained to be comfortable in this type of medium?
I see it beginning. I had the privilege of visiting a couple of primary care training programs recently down in the Carolinas and in Virginia that are P4, that are patient-centered medical home embracing primary care training programs, of which those numbers are really expanding. And when I talk to the young docs coming out of those programs, they get this. They understand this. They're ready to deliver this.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring it back to this domestic workforce issue again, because we clearly have to focus on transformation. And the federal health reform law made it clear that we have to expand our definition of who's a primary care provider to include not just physicians, but also nurse practitioners and physician's assistants, and that they need to be able to lead primary care homes as well. The model relies heavily on RNs as care coordinators. And then there's so many other people, patient navigators, the healthcare coaches, health information technology people, all the way down the line. So it seems we need to look at this whole issue of healthcare workforce training very broadly, much more broadly than we've done in the past, and get out of our silos a little bit. Domestically, where do you see the leadership for that transformation coming to get out of the silos between the health professions?
What do I see is really the societal change agents driving this. It's really fascinating to watch, because the last huge transformation we held in healthcare was really driven by the DOD and the Veterans Administration. When out of World War II, and even in fact in World War II, they decided to specialize. They decided to then create training programs around all of the Veterans Administrations in academic health centers, which, by the way, is where half of our residents train. And that was, you know, that was that evolution into what evolved into high-end, high-procedure cost medicine, right? Mm-hmm. So you look at where they're going now. I mean, they both are, the DOD and the VA have said every vet, every DOD member will have a medical home, you know, by 2012. And they're driving towards that big time.
I always like to ask our guests, when they look around the country and the world, what do they see in terms of innovations, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
We have whole states that are profoundly changing the way care is delivered. Community care in North Carolina is an example where they really focused on Medicaid, and we saw decreases in asthma hospitalization by 44%. Vermont has really stepped up to medical homes in every community. They're rolling it out. And there they've integrated community health, wellness, and a blueprint for health. There are some great examples of places around the United States that are really already stepping up and making a difference.
Well, you're right, and those are all areas that we have been keeping our eye on. Today we've been speaking with Dr. Paul Grundy, IBM's Global Director of Healthcare Transformation and President of the Patient-Centered Primary Care Collaborative. Dr. Grundy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Only a pleasure.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. This week's bright idea focuses on new technology that's helping asthma patients and their doctors better monitor the disease day by day. Asthmopolis is a collection of disease tracking services that helps to determine the triggers of asthma. Although much progress has been made in understanding asthma, morbidity remains high. Every year, asthma accounts for 2 million ER visits and 27 million missed days of school and work. These high rates are largely due to the fact that doctors and patients still lack crucial information about where and when asthma symptoms develop. That's where Asthmopolis comes in. Here's how it works. Patients attach Asthmopolis tracking device to the top of their inhalers. It's basically a GPS to pinpoint the time and location of each inhaler use. The device is used in tandem with Asthmopolis's mobile diary, which can be accessed on any computer or phone with a web browser. The mobile diary compiles the device's data to map asthma triggers, symptoms, and inhaler use, giving patients a comprehensive look at how their disease affects them day to day and when and where it affects them. Patients can also program the mobile diary to text them medication reminders. Researchers conducted in partnership with the CDC last year showed that these kinds of real-time reports made a big difference in how effectively patients manage their asthma. Asthmopolis was featured in the Department of Health's Community Health Data Initiative launched earlier this month. The presenters had this to say about the trial run.
Patients reported more awareness of patterns of asthma, a better understanding of their triggers, and also, most importantly, I think, better and more regular use of their controller medications.
Asthmopolis not only improves individual patient quality of life, it also uses crowdsourcing technology to map population-level data about asthma for public health research. On both the micro and the macro level, Asthmopolis is helping change the way patients, their physicians, and public health agencies manage asthma. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.